welcome to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to Titus Mills, who is the headmaster of Port Regis School, but I'm with him in Arnhem, a home of Operation Market Garden in 1944. And Titus has, for, I think, 18 years, been getting to know veterans and then telling people, including on the Oldie Tour, about what it was really like in Operation Market Garden. And can you explain, to begin with, Titus, to those listeners who don't know, what was Operation Market Garden and why did it go so wrong?
Wow, two massive questions, yeah. Harry. Let me try to answer that concisely. What was Operation Market Garden? It was the most ambitious airborne operation of all time. It was the brainchild of Monty, who was rather obsessed with it, and he thought that it was a brilliant, audacious plan to bring the ghastly war to an end, hopefully by Christmas of 1944. To fully understand it, one needs to backtrack a little bit in back to June 44, the Normandy landings. The Allies were getting finally on the front foot. Things were going very well in the summer of 44. The Germans were being pushed back, actually at great pace through northern France. Paris was liberated, and on the Allies pushed them back into Belgium, and morale was sky high. But there were problems developing in the summer of 44 as well. In a way, the Allies were, you know, they were victims of their own success, because the front line was moving at such pace in the summer of 44 that all the supply lines were getting overstretched, all the fuel and ammunition and men coming onto the beaches in Normandy then were having to travel further and further north with the advance. And that was a concern to the Allies, as were the V1 and V2 rockets in the summer of 44, Hitler resorting to these lethal new flying bombs which were being launched from the Netherlands into the southeast of England and doing a lot of damage at the same time. And there was concern as well that the Russians were moving equally fast and might get to Berlin before the Brits and the Americans. And so, although there was great success in the summer of 44, there were these growing concerns. And it was Monty who said, how about this for an operation? And it was called Market Garden, and it was daring and ambitious, and it required dropping elite airborne troops behind enemy lines in the Netherlands to secure all sorts of bridges across all sorts of waterways. And the American troops were going to take the bridges to the south in Eindhoven and Nijmegen. And the Brits really drew the short straw and were to take the bridge at Arnhem, 60 miles.
Sorry to interrupt, which is for our listeners.
Yes.
In the famous film, A Bridge Too Far.
Indeed. That is Too Far. Yes. Frederick Browning, Boy Browning, challenged Monty, saying, I wonder, sir, whether we are going a bridge too far. And he was right. Browning got lots of things wrong, but he was right with that assessment. And so the Brits had to take the bridge at Arnhem and hold it, they thought, for 3 days before huge numbers of men, Second Army, led by 30 Corps, came charging along this single road and relieved the airborne troops at the bridges and pushed on through the Netherlands, and then were going to spin round to the east into Germany and knock out Hitler's industrial heartland in the Ruhr Valley. And it was all about speed and surprise, and Monty thought, well, the Germans are on the back foot. They're unravelling anyway. There's so much evidence that just with one final big confident push, we're going to bring the war to a conclusion. And so that was it in essence, but so much of the vision went wrong, and it went particularly wrong here at Arnhem.
And I think you first came here in 2008, is that right?
Yes, 2009, the 65th anniversary. I had been challenged by a remarkable man, an Arnhem veteran called Colonel John Waddy. And I'd gone to have tea with him because I was obsessed with meeting as many old people as I could with remarkable stories, particularly veterans from World War One and World War Two. And Waddy told me about how seriously he had been wounded in the Battle of Arnhem. I knew very little about the battle. And he challenged me and he said, "Titus, you're a school teacher. You really ought to start taking some school children out to this battlefield to learn about these stories, because all the Dutch school children know the battle inside out. And hardly anyone here in Britain does." And I was rather cowering in the presence of Waddy. He not only survived Arnhem, but he was very senior in the SES. And when he challenges someone, you kind of you get into action. And so I followed out his orders, and I came for the 65th anniversary. And I was blown away by the stories I was hearing. There were about 250 Arnhem veterans for that particular event, and I was completely hooked. And since then, I've been bringing school groups, not just children, but their parents as well, to learn about this extraordinary 9-day battle.
And I and several oldie readers have had the benefit of your wonderful tour today. I think it's completely unique, which is to tell the story of Arnhem through particular veterans, those who've died and those who you knew. I wonder if you could illustrate this, the particular story of a veteran you knew and what light it sheds on Arnhem.
Yes, there are so many. I think there are quite a lot of battlefield tours out there, and certainly some connected with Arnhem, and you can get rather bogged down in operational matters and wading through strategy and you know, trying to understand the complexities of the battle at the kind of macro level. And I'm more interested in really pushing in on the personal stories, the individual stories. And I've had the great joy and privilege of meeting so many Arnhem veterans. I mean, one that springs to mind, actually, is a story I didn't tell today, but I will tell tomorrow, of a lovely chap called Ron Johnson, who became a very dear friend, and he was a glider pilot. And he was fighting here. He didn't make it to Arnhem Bridge, but he was part of the defensive perimeter 4 miles west of Arnhem in the little village of Oosterbeek. And he was, at one point in the battle, in his slit trench. There was fierce fighting going on around him. A German mortar exploded in the slit trench 5 meters from Ron. It killed the two British airborne soldiers in that slit trench, and all the muck, all the shrapnel flew through the air, and poor old Ron got lots of metal splinters in his face, and he dragged himself out of the slit trench, and kind of in and out of consciousness, he walked back to the main medical dressing station, and the medics spent about an hour picking all of these metal splinters out of his face, and they bandaged his face up, enabling him just to see out and speak out. But he looked like a kind of Egyptian mummy, and he staggered back to his slit trench because he knew there was a job still required. He'd lost his rifle, and he went over to the other slit trench to check whether the men were dead, and they were, and he just took one of their rifles and he returned to his own slit trench. And as he was lowering himself back in, a German sniper shot him through the back, and the bullet flew out of the top of his right arm, and he staggered back to the medical station, and they said, "Not you again. We've just had an hour with you." And Ron told me this story many times. He told it to me as I sat next to him on his 100th birthday in a hotel in Oxfordshire. And but he said on this occasion, "Do you want to see the scar?" And I said, "Okay, Ron, show me." And I'll never forget, he rolled up the sleeve of his shirt, rather a smart shirt, since it was birthday. And there was this massive scar, still, whatever it was, 78 years on. That generation carrying not just physical scars, but the kind of mental and emotional scars that they carried all through their lives. I think I really gasped when I saw the extent of the damage to his shoulder. But that's just one of so many stories, and I just feel with great passion, although Ron is not with us anymore, that story and the other stories of Ron and of his friends must be preserved, must be shared, and particularly the friends of Ron, who did not survive the 9-day battle at Arnhem. And we were at the cemetery today, and we walk up and down those rows of graves, and they're 19 and they're 20 and they're 21. They hardly lived a life at all, and we owe it to them to preserve their stories and to keep their legacy alive and to honour them. I rather thought that as the last Arnhem veterans kind of passed away, I might draw a line under this kind of treasure trove of stories that I've... Actually, not a bit of it. I feel quite the opposite. I feel I need to do more to make sure that the stories are shared and that people understand them. So that's why we're sitting here today.
Yes. And I think there's one Arnhem veteran left. And so you're going to be in a difficult position because first-hand stories are so crucial. You are now the second-hand bearer of first-hand stories because the day the last veteran of Arnhem or the Second World War dies, you lose a great link with the truth, don't you?
Yes, that's right. Yes, there are fortunately still some local Dutch folk who were children or teenagers and remember the battle vividly. But you're right, with the passing of the last actual soldier, that will be the close of a chapter. But then that ties back to what I was saying earlier. All the more reason to really be galvanised to make sure that their stories are recorded and told and safeguarded because they can so easily slip away. They can so easily be stored in dusty boxes in people's attics and then thrown away. And the stories resonate 82 years on. They don't age. They're as relevant today as they were then. And I feel with great passion as a headmaster that the younger generation really need to hear them and that there are a lot of lessons about life and core values and morality in this strange kind of curriculum that has built up around the Battle of Arnhem, a rather unique curriculum of learning. But it's very powerful and I think it's very relevant.
And presumably your pupils, even the naughtiest ones, if you do have any naughty ones, must be blown away. They must have been particularly blown away when they could meet veterans.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And when the children come and they come with their parents, I ask each family to research one soldier. In fact, I give them the name of a soldier who was killed here at Arnhem, and they have to prepare a presentation on that soldier, which they will normally do by his gravestone or in the woodland where that soldier was killed. And they hold up a picture of that soldier. And it makes the whole thing real and powerful to these children. And it kind of hooks them in. And very often we can then, once we've heard their talk on this soldier, we call their next of kin, son, daughter, maybe a niece or a nephew who's waiting by the phone, and we put them on loudspeaker. And that's very moving. Again, it's a powerful way of hooking the young in. And the whole story feels real and powerful and compelling, not dry and dull and abstract from an textbook. And so I think that works well.
And one of the remarkable things about coming here, I've never been here before, but brought up on a bridge too far. So my only association is with the war. It's astonishingly beautiful and a rather prosperous part of the world, and it didn't work out, the Allies' effort. And yet the Dutch, despite the failure, are extremely grateful. Everywhere you go, there are flags and commemorative monuments to the Allies.
Yes, it's an extraordinary feature of the battle. This very strong bond between the British and the Dutch. So much of the fighting was going on in Dutch families' homes or gardens. And yes, after 25 years of commemorations here in 1969, the British said to the Dutch, I mean, shouldn't we wind it up? I mean, we're so grateful for all your appreciation of what went on. But, you know, 25 years on, we should probably draw a line under it. And the locals said, what are you talking about? We will go on commemorating what happened for generations to come, because it is important to us, and a lot of blood was shed. And yes, it was a disaster. Yes, the operation failed, but a lot of young men tried and gave their lives to try and liberate the Dutch. And we will never forget that. And so we will go on putting the flags out, and the Dutch children will go on putting flowers at the graves. And the crowds last September, what was it, the 82nd anniversary? I mean, the enormous numbers of
getting
locals.
Bigger, or certainly no smaller.
Getting bigger. Yeah. I mean, in the when they do the drops out in Ginkle Heath, the parachute drops, which they do every year. I mean, there are about 60,000 Dutch who gather, and the service in the cemetery. You know, thousands of people. So this is not something that is quietly kind of ebbing away. And I think it does make Arnhem and the fighting here rather distinctive and different, perhaps, from other battles on other battlefields. So it's an extraordinary thing, really.
If we could finish just by explaining what those children here do, and you described beautifully what they do when they come to the cemetery we saw today.
Yes, so there's always a beautiful service, very moving service in the cemetery. There are nearly 2,000 young men buried there. And towards the end of the service, you can hear the rustle of gravel outside of the cemetery, and an army of 2,000 children come into the cemetery, all of them carrying this beautiful array of coloured flowers of all shapes and sizes, and each child with each bouquet of flowers goes and stands opposite each grave, and then at the same time they lay the flowers down in front of the grave, and they whisper the name of that soldier. And when the veterans came, a lot of them would refer to that moment, and it really broke a lot of them. I mean, the emotion was tangible, and you know, it is extraordinary. These are young children who weren't alive in the course of the battle. Their parents weren't alive, and yet they are honouring those brave young men from 1944, and it leaves a mark. It makes a great impression.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. And thank you so much to Titus Mills for appearing on Radio Oldie.
My absolute pleasure.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.